We have finished chapter 3, and we're ready to start with chapter 4. It's hard to believe we're getting close to the end of James. Chapter 5 is a long one, though. Chapter 4 is fairly short. The title I have in for chapter 4 is Conflict with People and God. Have you ever been in a church where there was conflict? I don't mean the denomination. I mean the local church.
there's another kind.
Well, I don't mean the conflict with the North America with the General Conference, but conflict with the local church.
That's what I'm talking about. I didn't know there was another kind of church.
There's the local church. There's the universal church. There's regions of churches. There's different references in the Bible to all of those. So
I'm talking about, I didn't know there were churches that didn't have conflict and quarreling going on. I don't know what denomination that is.
We once joined a church where people from the first service were suing the second service.
Oh, no.
And the conference and everything else, and they had separate potlucks and everything. It was distressing. Yes,
we had a conflict several years ago. The head elder resigned because the pastor wouldn't do what he wanted him to do, and he then went around bad mouthing the pastor and trying to get a following. I think his goal was to oust the pastor. It was pretty messy. The pastor was led by God to go to another church. And I think that was a wise decision.
Yes.
But I thought it was pretty audacious for the head elder to think that the pastor should do everything he wanted him to do.
Yeah, that's difficult because you have this organizational structure thing that we live with, that the church technically is authoritatively operated by the board. And the pastor is a hired employee of the conference,
mm-hmm.
who's placed there. And so they get to decide who's going to be your pastor and when and all this kind of, because they work for the conference, not the local church. However, the local church, the board, is technically, legally responsible for the operation of that organization. And so it makes for messy.
But the head elder is not in either camp.
The head elder is on the board. And
yes, he is, but he doesn't run the board.
Well, not necessarily. There's no structural reason that the pastor has to be the chairman of the board.
No, what I mean is he doesn't, the head elder, I'm talking separately from the pastor, the head elder
right.
does not run the board. He's simply a member.
Nobody could be. The head elder could be the chairman of the board.
He could be, but it's, in my experience, it's been rare.
That's true. It's usually the pastor. But what I'm saying is some churches start to feel their oats and say, you know, we want the chairman of the board should be somebody who's an administrator. We wanted a pastor who's a people person. We want an administrator to run the board.
Well, listen.
Are you having a conflict over this?
Not anymore.
I'm leaving. I need to get something, but just kidding.
I'm telling you where some of these conflicts start at, because there's churches that feel their oats and they just say, this is our church, it's our board, and you can send a pastor in here if you want. And then the conference says, you have only a church because we say you can be a church and put the Seventh-day Adventist name on. So, I mean, it goes back and forth. This stuff, it happens all the time.
In the cases at PUC Church, anyway, the chair of the board is never the pastor. Never. In fact, that's considered a conflict of interest.
Right. That's what I was saying.
So the chair of the board is, I think, often involved in the business aspects of the church, the financial aspects.
And legally. I mean, the church being sued is that board. They're coming after that board of directors.
So that's how it's been working at PUC. The head elder is simply the head elder. Elders don't have a lot of power. They have power to influence. They have power to do things within their purvey, right. But they don't run the church.
No, but unless you're elected to do so.
As a member, and that's how it worked in the Pacific Union Conference. I haven't been to a lot of little churches, so I can't tell you much there. I think it is probably different in smaller
churches. It's almost always the pastor who's the chairman of the board. But once in a while, you get these churches who will, some person is a great administrator, and the pastors come and go. And so the local church board says, we have to keep some kind of organization going here. We want somebody as an administrator to run the operation of the church. And sometimes that's the head elder. It could be anybody. Could be nobody that's elected, you know.
It's been at the PUC church. It's been somebody who's not the head elder and somebody who's not the pastor. Mm. Usually someone in finances.
Specialist, right.
I may be wrong, but that's been my sense of things. Okay, we are ready to start with chapter 4. We just were waiting for Brad and Nancy to get here.
Sorry.
We had a technical difficulty.
I was being tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, all right. Thank you. Thank you. We're here to rescue you any way we can.
I read the title and we got into a conflict over it. No, I'm kidding. The title is conflict with people and God.
Yes.
We were looking for the church of no conflict and we couldn't find that anywhere in the directory of denominations.
Good luck for that.
I want the first church of sinners.
There you go.
I do know of a church that I don't think, unless, of course, conflicts never come to the fore, but I know of a church that is pretty well melded together, and that's the Azure Hills Church.
Nice.
I think a little southwest of Loma Linda.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I've been there before.
Seemed healthy when we attended.
It seems to have been healthy for many years.
Yes.
Lucrative church membership. Okay. Nancy?
Yes.
I ask you to read chapter 4, verses 1 through 3.
All right, I'll read it. And I have NIV. Okay. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You want something, but don't get it. You kill and covet, but you cannot have what you want. You quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God. When you ask, you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, that you may spend what you get on your pleasures.
I think of Ellen White's statement that no church meetings like board meetings and elder meetings and so on should be held when you've just eaten. You should go out and chop wood. I may be messing this up. It's been years since I heard this.
I have not heard that, but
I know she advocates chopping wood. if you have, I think especially if you're dyspeptic, which means you have an ulcer, you're supposed to go chop wood rather than take it out on people in the church.
Yeah. Some people hit racquetballs really hard against a wall. Other people do all kinds of energy expenditure. I think it's a good idea.
Except when you have a roommate like I had in college who played racquetball and she lost the game and she was so angry she came in and walked me up. Take it out.
Dear.
Why don't you beat up that pillow over there?
Not the idea.
We have found in therapist circles that while physical exertion is good, it does require, if you're really angry, don't focus on the thing that you're really angry about, but be involved in physical exertion. And if you feel like hitting something, do the opposite action, you know, not yelling, not screaming, not punching things,
we found that that doesn't really calm the brain down. Physical exertion does, but not with the focus on what you're angry about.
Yeah, get your mind on what you're doing rather than what you've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think diversion is a very healthy thing. Great to deal with stress in general.
Mm-hmm.
I think the positive effect of sports has a lot to do with the personality type, because there's a lot of people that say golf is not good for your language. other people can play golf and it's very relaxing and it's a very good time for them. Other people, it's like they're breaking clubs and yelling at people and swearing and cussing. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, some people are very competitive. Some people just do things for the enjoyment of it and everything in between. So mm-hmm.
You need to do what I did as a child. A few little boys who were in the class behind me had lost the one girl that they had playing softball with them. And so they came up to me and said, you know, Janet moved away. Would you take her place and be our girl?
There you go.
And I said, I don't know how to play. They said, we'll teach you. So I ended up playing softball. We played workup. We didn't play teams. We played workup.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great therapy for me because I was out with my female classmates. So this was a perfect antidote to that.
Mm-hmm.
So how many possible solutions to church fights could there be if we weren't jealous? We weren't lustful. That word is not in any version, I think. I think they, translators modernly avoid the word lust, but I think the King James says that we don't avoid that word. Let's see what else is in here. My version uses the word cravings. Something you desire so bad you can't live without it.
Does your verse 2 say, so you commit murder? What did the one?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Pretty strong. You lust and do not have, so you commit murder.
This is what happens when people run amok and let their feelings control, and their feelings become very powerful. I don't know if you've ever read the book. Well, this is the older title. I don't remember what the new title is. It's been republished. But Escape from the Supernatural by Roger Morneau. This is a fascinating story of a man who lived in Montreal, Quebec. He had served during World War II in the French Army. So this is a very fascinating book by this gentleman, Roger Morneau. He was a young man when the story starts, and he had been through World War II in the French Army and among the Allies. And he had a curiosity about many things. He'd been raised Catholic, and he didn't think much of the picture of God that the Catholic Church had. But his parents contained a very lovely picture of God, and so he kind of tied into that. But and during the war, he'd lost faith in God, and he couldn't understand suffering. So he decided God didn't exist, and he became an atheist. And after the war, he met a friend of his, a buddy from the war days, and they ended up going to a seance. And while they were at the seance, they met a man who seemed very intelligent and very knowable, and he took them out to eat, and he invited them to his worship service. Well, it turned out that the worship service was in the Church of Satan, and he went several times. He learned a lot about the Church of Satan, and before the time went over, I mean, before long, they were going to induct him into the Church of Satan. He had to go to a certain retreat and do certain things, probably human sacrifice, though that book doesn't say. And what happened in the meantime is that, I'm forgetting the detail. Katrina, you've read the book, haven't you?
I do know that story. I've read some of his prayer books, and then I have read the story of how he, yes, but I can't remember.
I can't remember if he got a new job. I think he got a new job.
He went downstairs, and they had all these pictures up everywhere.
Right. They had pictures of the gods.
All the people going there were, like, really wealthy, and you know, if you become part of us, you know, you'll, anyway, and the spirit, yes.
So they were worshiping the demons, basically. And
yeah, they were devil worshiping.
But at work, a new person came, and, or else he got a new job. That was it. And he had to work by this person. And he couldn't get the threader to work on the machine. It was a textile machine where they made material for clothing. And he couldn't get the threader to work. And he started cussing and swearing. And the guy behind him didn't do that, but they were able together to get work. And so finally, they went out to lunch, and they started talking, and it found out this new person was an Adventist. So Roger started talking to him about his beliefs and everything, and the Adventist said, you know, just take it easy on the Lord. You know, he doesn't really care to have his name taken in vain. You know, and as they kept talking, Roger got more and more interested, and he felt this hunger that he had to find out everything he could about Adventists. And so he asked to start Bible studies, and they said, well, maybe a week from now we can start. He's no, I need to start tonight. Mm-hmm. And in the next few nights, they covered all the beliefs of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I mean, they did one after another, hour after hour after hour. And he asked to be baptized.
Wow.
He knew that he had to do this in order to avoid becoming a Satanist.
Hmm.
And of course, the Satanists put a price on his head. They wanted to kill him.
Because he knew too much?
He knew too much. He knew about the inside scoop of the Church of Satan. I'm trying to remember the one thing that happened. The Satanist priest said that Satan gets people to have strong feelings about certain viewpoints that are wrong. In other words, a viewpoint is wrong. He gets them to have strong feelings about that viewpoint so that his stronghold can't be broken.
That fits.
I think that we see that happening in this world.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of strong opinions are being held, as well as strong viewpoints, and people are very emotionally wrought up about it.
The word pride pops in my brain.
Yeah, well, we're going to come to that, I think, right in the second.
Before you go on, I wanted to comment. Dr. Dick Neese used to talk about spiritism, which was not spiritualism, but this focus on letting your feelings dictate what your reality is.
Yeah.
Your feelings are real, but they're not reality. And I think his point was that it could lead to spiritualism, but it was a much more subtle thing that if we let our feelings dictate our reality or tell us what reality is, that's a like a primary weapon of the enemy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's very much in harmony with what Roger Murnau
I just looked up Gene and I discovered that there's been a film made about his life. It looks like it's a well-made film. I can't tell. 2019. It's called Charmed by Darkness.
Huh.
Mm. I might end up showing this in my film class, but yep. I would like to see that.
I wasn't aware of that.
Charmed by Darkness, 2019. Just says Roger Morneau was a demon worshiper who became a Christian author and prayer warrior. Yeah. Family and friends testify that the battle with fallen angels is real and that prayer can really change things. Yeah. And on Wikipedia, it says, as a young adult, Morneau was introduced to spiritualism through a friend and nearly joined a secret order of spirit worshippers who claimed to be the elite. Before he was to make a full commitment, however, he asked a Seventh-day Adventist co-worker, Cyril Gross, to go over some Bible studies with him. This turned him away from spiritualism and began his studies of Christ as an Adventist. Morneau claims there was a threat of a bounty on his head of $10,000, which in 2012 was approximately $126,000, right? So it was a lot more money than what we think it is now. Should he join the Adventist Church? So anyway, that tells a little bit more of his story.
There's another book that he's written that is less known. It's called Beware of Angels.
Yeah.
Story of some fanatical Adventists in Southern Oregon who got so caught up in following what they thought were God's angels telling them what to do that they actually committed murder.
Yes, I remember that. They've got his books listed here on Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. Beware of Angels, Deceptions in the Last Days, published in 1997. Yep. There's Charmed by Darkness, which is published in 2015. I think we got that book. I don't remember, but we got the Incredible Answers.
Because there's a lot of support in his story and his journey for understanding that what so many people don't understand in our world today is that demons can personify people. They can personify them to the nth degree. They did that in the Church of Satan. I'm sorry to get derailed on that, but it has so many implications for what we're looking at. That when we're talking about our emotions controlling our reason and our emotions controlling what we think, that's Satan's working that.
Of course, Satan works the other side of the street too. He's an equal opportunity deceiver, because in Adventism we often fall into the opposite trap where we think our feelings are bad, we think our emotions are bad, and we suppress them, and that's every bit as bad as letting them rule.
Sure, yeah. Because emotions were created and designed by God. And there's some indication that after his own image, that may be part of what that in God's image means, is God gave us emotions so that we could enjoy similar things that God enjoys. Yeah. So you know, I think Mark's right. There's a nugget of corruption that's down under there somewhere, and it's not the emotions themselves.
Balance. I think it's always about balance. And when I've studied brain physiology and development, emotions are there pretty early on, and maturity is the development of the higher faculties of reason. And so I believe that the mature brain recognizes emotions, but they're always evaluated through the reasoning abilities. You don't want one, or we're all going to, you know, just emotions. I watch my 3-year-old grandson and I go, wow, okay. Or 18-month-old grandsons. And boy, they're usually pretty strongly in touch with their feelings, even though they may need help identifying and naming them, which is a parental responsibility to do. And I know in therapy, when I worked with people with very strong emotions, we had to get those calmed down so their emotions and their brain could function. Their reasoning, thinking abilities could work in concert with their emotions and evaluate if they should continue with that emotional perspective or if that needed to be altered based on evidence.
Which is true that fear and the emotion of fear mm-hmm. and anger, those two emotions can mm-hmm. shut down the frontal lobes.
Exactly. That's what we see when we study the brain. Visualize that. You can actually visualize the frontal cortex reasoning ability shutting down.
I think this verse identifies what somebody just said with the underlying corruption, and that is when all this is focused on ourselves. Selfishness is what corrupts our feelings, and it also corrupts our reason.
Mm-hmm. You know, in our Sabbath school class today, you were looking at restlessness. That was the subject of the day here, restlessness and rebelliousness. And I was trying to get the people to think deeper and deeper and deeper. What is behind restlessness? Why do we not get God's rest? Why have we not come into it sometimes and in some situation? What is causing this? And then we get down to, well, we weren't satisfied with, or we wanted something we shouldn't have had, or all these kind of things. It's like Mark says, when you boil it down, selfishness is at the root of that, all the way at the bottom. That is restlessness. We become restless because of selfism. It's at the bottom of all these different things. It's lust and all these. Without the selfism part of it, they really don't have any life. It's at the foundational basis of our problem as sinners. It is, I mean, to me, it's a better definition than to go around using the word sinfulness. It's more helpful to use the word selfishness or selfism. It's down there at the bottom of all these different problems.
I really like that word selfism. That's a good one.
You know, there's actually a word in the dictionary. If you look at an unabridged dictionary, they've actually come out with that word selfism. Mm-hmm. And I always say it's because we have become so extremely adept at selfishness that we could actually come up with the word selfism.
Yeah. Anything else in this passage what is interesting is verse 2, you long for something you don't have, so you commit murder. You are jealous for something you can't get, so you struggle and fight. You don't have because you don't ask.
Yeah, wow.
Isn't that an interesting response to that? You shouldn't want those things. Stop, you know, trying to get them. Mm-mm. No, stop trying to get them and ask for them.
Well, look
and
at
don't
verse
ask
3,
with
though.
The wrong motive.
Right, that's what I was going to say, is look at verse 3. It's and this is curious to me, because mine is NASB, and it says because you ask with wrong motives. But mm-hmm. I checked several other NET, the New King James Version, I think, and several others, they say wrongly. In other words, you don't ask correctly. They don't say motive.
Mine spells it out. You ask and don't have because you ask with evil intentions to waste it on your own cravings.
It spells it instead of using
what
one
version
word.
Is that?
Verse 3.
Three.
What version is that?
Common English Bible.
Oh.
And Free Bible Version says you ask with wrong motive, wanting to spend what you'd receive on selfish pleasures.
Yeah.
Same idea.
Yeah, I did a study one time on motives, the word motives, and in Ellen White's writings, and then also in the Bible. And in the Bible, either if you jump around to a bunch of translations, or you have to know kind of what you're looking for, because the word isn't there, but it's insinuating the exact same thing as if they use the word. And so if you do that, a lot of things clear up in questions about how God operates. Why did God bless this, and why did God protect that, and why did God not do this time, and why did God do? he knows God only does what's good for us. And only God can figure that out, because only God knows the motives. He knows something that he would not ever bless me with. He might totally give Mark as much as he wants, because he knows the motive and what my motive is with that particular thing that I'm asking for, praying for. God uses his inside knowledge of our deepest motives and things to do it properly. We get all torn up sometimes, and, well, I don't know why God didn't fix that or protect that person. That's because we don't read people's motives or what's going on in their mentality at the time about that particular thing. Fortunately, God does.
I wish you would tell God that he could give me everything I wanted. That would be a real blessing.
Yeah. Well, maybe not. Some things that you, if you got told God to give me Buzz everything that he wanted, I might be dead tomorrow.
I think he said ask, not that you don't tell.
There you go.
Good point.
Okay, are we done with that passage and ready to go on? Okay, Brad, I'm going to pick on you next.
Okay.
Can you please read down to verse through verse 10?
All right. Verse 4 through 10.
Yeah.
You adulterous people, don't you realize that friendship with the world is hatred towards God? Those who want to be friends of the world make themselves enemies of God. Do you think Scripture doesn't mean what it says, that the Spirit that he put in us is very jealous? 6. But God gives us more, even more grace, as Scripture says. God is against those who are arrogant, but gives grace to those who are humble. So place yourself under the direction, God's direction. Confront the devil, and he will run away from you. Come close to God, and he will come close to you. Wash your hands, you sinners. Purify your ways of thinking, you people with divided loyalties. Show some remorse, cry, and weep. Turn your laughter into mourning and your joy into sadness. Be humble before the Lord, and he will lift you up.
That's a loaded passage, or shall we begin?
Rude.
I think in this world view, the world is under the dominion of Satan. It's under the power of the devil. And so it's very much a black and white scenario that he's painting. If you're with one, then you can't be with God. And it's interesting that over the centuries, you know, Roman Catholic theology has a sacramental view of the world, and that the world is something that is good, that's beautiful, that's created by God, and that the world even becomes a means by which God speaks to us and communicates to us. And we also of God. And so that's why literature and art and, you know, painting expresses God to us. And so, you know, we might come at this and say, well, yes, the natural world represents God. Is he talking about the natural world? Do not love the natural world, or the love of God isn't in you? What is it about the world that he's talking about here? Because, you know, John tells us that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. You know, what is it that we shouldn't be friends with? And if we take this literally, right, we could end up in, you know, isolation actually from the world. Like, we shouldn't even be friends with someone who doesn't know God, right? And so that affects our evangelism, and we create bubbles of existence in which we operate. How far should we take this advice, or can we try to figure out what exactly is it about the world that we should avoid?
Seems to me that verse 4 and 7 just really identify how critical it is for us to realign ourselves with God. Mine says, "You adulterous people." There's a quote which I will slaughter, but it's basically, "I've looked at the enemy and it is me." So when I look at what's going on in my own heart and realign that with God's heart, then, you know, my desires can become God-like. God says, "I want to give you the desires of your heart." The only problem is your desires are all aligned with who I created you to be. So for me, at least, you know, the clicker is, what's, how does my heart and my desires align or not align with that?
Yeah, I'd like to piggyback on that a little bit. When John says God so loved the world, mm-hmm. he meant the people in the world, but he demonstrates that he is the source of love and the world is not the source of love. And the problem becomes when we look at the world as the source of love mm-hmm. and we try to emulate it in its brokenness and in its sinfulness, not recognizing that God and God alone is the source of love in its purity.
Does God love the natural world though? Like he only loves the people, the wicked people in the world? He loves the natural world too. He loves the animals and
you're dealing with the cosmos. Okay. The word in Greek is cosmos for both passages, John 3:16 and James 4:4. So it's a very broad term for the world.
And yes, God loves even the evil people in the world, including Satan himself.
So my six tests, nothing in James's context suggests a literal interpretation of verse 4. This is the Adventist NIV study. Mm-hmm. It is metaphorical for the unfaithfulness of the community. The world stands for the values and actions that are at odds with God's requirements.
Yeah, that's how I see it. I think if we went back up to chapter 3, we weren't going to do that today, but we did it last week. It may be parallel to the earth. Instead, verse 15 says, instead it is from the earth, natural and demonic. Wherever there is jealousy and selfish ambition, there's disorder and everything that is evil. That's what they means by the world.
For me, I always interpret this as the way the world works, which is very much not the way God works. So if I really like the survival of the fittest and, you know, power to those who can get it, that's what loving the world means to me. Again, that goes back to the selfishness. I want a world in which I can get ahead by my own work, my own merit. That's the way I want the world to work. And if I love that, that to me is what this is talking about.
In the next verse 5, doesn't God long for our faithfulness and the life he has given to us? I think is something very different in your versions. So maybe you can refresh my memory. This has a whole lot of footnotes. Or jealously, doesn't God jealously long for our faithfulness and the life he has given to us? Or doesn't the spirit that God placed in us have jealous desires? It sounds a little contradictory there, which is why I think that my translator, whoever he is or she, translated this quite differently.
The Good News Bible says for verse 5, don't think that there's no truth in the scripture that says the spirit that God placed in us is filled with fierce desires. Which if you unwind the double negative, basically says that the spirit that God placed in us is filled with fierce desires, which might take us back to the thing that, yeah, God created us with the strong emotions, but then you go to the next verse, it says, but you know, grace is stronger than that.
Mine says, or do you think scripture says without reason that he jealously longs for the spirit he has caused to dwell in us.
I like that. I think that puts everything together quite nicely, so it's understandable. But he gives us more grace. That's why God says God stands against the proud but favors the humble. And that's quoting Proverbs 3:34. So at the root of our selfishness, isn't there pride? And I'm not talking about pride as an arrogance. I'm talking about pride as a fundamental human response when we feel crossed. We kind of stiffen our necks and go, no, I don't want to have to admit I'm wrong.
It seems like pride is the natural reaction to that focus on self.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of goes hand in hand with it. It's almost impossible to talk about one without the other.
Yeah.
But that's how we further knowledge, back and forth, this dialogue, this conversation. It's healthy. It can be done in a bad way, but it's liberating when it's done in the right way. I mean, dialogue leading to understanding, to sharing, and sharing deeply. It's not always pride that's motivating that. If you want to come back, say something, and then the other person corrects you, and then you correct them, and you continue. That was the whole point of philosophy, right? Of having the dialogue and the conversation.
Yeah, I wanted to modify what I just said. There is, in fact, an appropriate pride. If I'm reveling in the fact that, wow, God has given me some really good gifts, and God has enabled me to do some really good things with those gifts, that's an appropriate pride, because it's not primarily centered on myself. So yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I think as long as God is the one getting the glory for things, and our focus is on him and not ourselves, there's no room for pride, the wrong kind. Also, verse 7, therefore submit to God, resist the devil, and he will run away from you. Come near to God, and he will come near to you. How do we resist the devil? When I'm tempted, if I say no, that temptation usually ends quite quickly. That's one way to look at it. Are there others?
I think about this, the story of what happened to Josh Duggar, and how, you know, he was found out to be, you know, visiting prostitutes, even being violent with them, leading this double life. And it turned out he'd molested his sisters when they were all teenagers. And so it had a starting point, right? When he was a young man and was curious. And I said, oh, it's not like people saying, oh, you're a rapist and a pedophile. No, that's not true. And then it turned out that he'd been on these sites that where you can have affairs and this kind of thing. So he came from a conservative Christian counting family. You know, they have that show, 19 Kids and Counting, and then that was cancelled as a result, and then they had the other one. And then, you know, he was sent off to a self-help program, which he did for 6 months, and supposedly, you know, he's recovered. But just a few months ago, he was arrested for having over 200 child pornography images on his computer, and was supposed to be tried now, and he wanted to push it off for 6 months. Now it's going to take place in November. But again, when we see how it was something that he just did not say no to, right? It continued from the molestation of his sisters, and most of it, they said, happened at night when they were sleeping, and so they weren't fully aware. But to now, he's in, you know, being charged with this very serious crime for which he might have to pay $250,000 fine and potentially get 40 years in prison. So it's just a point where we consciously have to say no. And Ellen White says that even if, you know, something, there's something that we can't control, right? We're out of control in that area of our life. We can submit our will to God and say, God, help me. I can't make the right choice. I can't make the right decision. But you step in and do that for me through your spirit, that we can gain the victory, that we can gain freedom. But at some point, people have to make a choice, a decision to say no to something because it's wrong and it's leading me down the wrong path. And so instead of indulging in something, right, it says in verse 9, it says in verse 8, come near to God and he will come near to you. And it gives a series of steps. Wash your hands. You sinners, purify your heart. So stop doing whatever it is that you're doing, but that's only the starting point because it's what's in your heart, right, that is leading to your action. So you need to purify your heart because you're double-minded, right? You say, oh, yes, I want to do this or I don't want to do that, but you still do it. But what needs to happen in verse 9, it says, grieve, mourn, and wail, right? Recognize the evil for what it is. You need to grieve it. You need to have true sorrow. You need to stop laughing. You need to mourn, right? Don't be joyful. Be gloomy and recognize the evil of what it is that you're engaging in. And then humble yourselves before the Lord and he will lift you up, right? So we're not going to stay in this down state, right? It's God who will lift us up out of it. But we need appropriate grief over the things that are evil and that are hurting other people in this world, not just ourselves, but are hurting others too.
So you talked about being of double mind. We need to put this with Romans 7:8, the things that I don't want to do or the things I do and the things I want to do are the things I don't do. Anyone who has dealt with an addiction in themselves or someone else knows that it's easy to say that, but it's really, really hard to do.
This passage about mourning reminds me of how pedophiles tend to behave. They tend to be just loving and happy and everything's going well and they're doing these terrible things to children. I don't think that's the only time we do that kind of posturing of double-mindedness, but it is extremely hard to convert a pedophile. According to counselors that I've heard or heard about, maybe, one said that it was next to impossible to ever get them to be normal. And that's true of other kinds of problems. When we're addicted to our emotions, to our feelings, it can be hard too if we're addicted to being happy to offset some of the things we're doing that are very harmful.
One definition of an addiction which should give pause to all of us is an addiction is a pathological relationship with a mood-altering experience. It basically means anything that you do to fix the way you are, the way you feel right at that moment, that's destructive. And that can be shopping, it can be food, it can be going to religious services, it can be anything that gets in the way of our dealing with life as God has presented itself to us.
We all seek things to comfort ourselves, and some of those can be destructive and dangerous, and some of them are just part of life. And if you can recognize what they are, I mean, yes, I guess there's a fine line between what's helpful and what's dangerous, like someone who goes out to exercise because they recognize that it's going to help their mood and their overall health and well-being. But then there are people who become addicted to it and they're always at the gym and they have bulging muscles and, you know, they carry it to extremes. It becomes self-worship. They worship their own body. And I think there's a lot of people on YouTube like that that are actually more into self-worship than they are into helping people. But it's just a matter of, you know, lengths that people go to. Some things are good and helpful. You know, maybe you want to have something comforting to eat because it's comforting and there's nothing wrong with that. But if it makes you 400 pounds or 600 pounds, then obviously that's going to be a problem.
Or if it takes a priority in your life.
That's why they put the word pathological in there. So it becomes a problem when, you know, you'd prefer to go to the gym than to deal with your wife or children. It becomes a problem when you're stealing time from work to go to the gym. Mm-hmm. You know, it becomes a problem, and especially it becomes a problem when, it reaches the level of an addiction when you say, okay, I need to stop this, and you can't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's if you're dealing with addiction, it's more than just them deciding, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. Because an addict says that every time they do it. So, okay, this is the last time. I never want to do this again. This is never going to happen again. And of course it does.
I think it's also trying to rescue ourselves from fear or from something that seems to make us less able to cope with life. And when we indulge in doing self-help and don't allow God to help us, that's a problem.
I took a class in seminary called Self-Care and Mission, and that was part of my Intercultural School of World Mission Studies class. And it was very interesting. It was very helpful. And one of the things that I learned in that class is that for missionaries, right, this was back in the early 2000s, but the biggest struggle for overseas missionaries crying out for help is pornography. That is their number one struggle because they're way off, you know, in some other distant land. And that was, you know, grabbing them. And so there are some different things that, you know, we learned as, you know, being an overseas missionary. How do you take care of yourself so you don't get into destructive habits, but you look after yourselves? And one of the things I remember was, look, don't feel guilty. If you need to go and spend a weekend or a day in a Western hotel just to sit on a chair and relax or have a cup of tea or whatever it is, don't feel guilty about that. Even if you're serving in a really impoverished area, if you need to do little things to practice self-care, to look after yourself so that you can become, you know, better at your servant and service, as a result, then you need to do that. And so I think it's good for us to practice, you know, self-care. Maybe if we, you know, err on the side of too much or too little, but we too as Christians are pilgrims and wanderers on this earth, and we need to find things that are good and uplifting, that are like a sanctuary for us, whether that's, you know, taking time to listen to a beautiful symphony or, you know, going for the walk in nature or allowing, you know, yourself to, you know, enjoy that bowl of ice cream or soy ice cream or whatever it is that you want, that we need to practice self-care along the way. And that's part of loving ourselves as we love our neighbors. because the same care that we give to our neighbors is hopefully what we will exercise for ourselves too.
That is so important. In recovery, they have something called HALT. Never get hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. And that all goes back to the self-care thing. We get ourselves in trouble when we don't pay attention to our own needs. And what is it they say in the, you know, if there's a loss of cabin pressure, put the mask on yourself first, and you're better able to your children and other people. And we tend to forget about that.
Yeah, I like that. I like that HALT thing.
Another thing that came to my mind in verse 9 about the sorrow and the mourning. Sometimes what leads us to addictions is grief unresolved or not let out or not allowed. And that if we could mourn, it would help us not to be addicted. Does that make sense?
Say the last sentence again.
If we could allow ourselves to mourn, we would not be so addicted.
Philip Yancey had it. I think that's what's so amazing about grace, where he goes and talks to the alcoholics. And the primary thing is to admit that you feel the way you do. And most addiction and most of our personal problems come from this ignoring the red light on the dashboard of our emotion that says something's wrong here. And as I said before, we as Adventists are particularly prone to that because we tend to think that our feelings are bad and they should be suppressed. And it leads to problems every time. So unresolved feelings like grief or anger. I mean, we need to be angry, but don't sin in it. You know, it doesn't say pretend you're not angry. I think these unresolved feelings are the source of a great deal of our problems. There's several books that go into this, but you know, we tend to think of ourselves as rational beings. And the truth, though, is that the rational part of our mind is a thin layer on the top that's there to keep us out of trouble, and that the real self is down below. And we tend to suppress it, and it gets even every time.
Yeah. And for some people have a hard time identifying what their feelings are. And, you know, anyone who's on the autism spectrum too can have a problem with that, just even identifying what the feeling is or knowing. I mean, there can be so many emotions there, but understanding it, giving a voice to it, identifying what they are can be difficult, you know, for some men too. Identifying what the feelings are, you know, operating in the rational zone, it can be hard. And, you know, I'm not a really emotional person in the sense that I don't show my emotions, but even when I'm by myself, sometimes I feel jealous of my female friends who can cry a lot or who can cry easily, because I don't. I tend to think through things. I don't tend to just sit there crying about it. But sometimes I wish I could, because then I feel, oh, I could just let it go. And so it's hard then.
I'm the same way. Of course, you know that I'm in the ASD spectrum. I have dry eye syndrome on top of that. So even when I want to cry, I can't. And it is healing. I think of two sisters who lost their brother here at PUC many years ago. The sister that was able to go screaming down the hall when she got the news and cried and cried and cried and cried and faced it, got through it much quicker than her sister, who was more thoughtful, more engaged, and more frontal lobe oriented. I remember talking with her about it and encouraging her to express her emotions as much as she could. But it's hard, especially if you grew up pushing a little off button every time you got emotional. It's very hard when you're an adult.
As with all things, it's the synthesis of the two. Well, somebody told me, no, synthesis gets really overused, but it's the combination of the two. It's the balance. You can get out of balance on either side, and mm-hmm. you know, getting the rational and the emotional sides of our natures to play nicely with each other and to be friends, you know, so that I speaking for myself, I have this war going on inside that my emotional side thinks that we should be more out there. My rational side keeps saying, no, that's dangerous. And getting the two to be friends and support each other rather than being at war with myself is the struggle that I have.
I think this is actually cry out in sorrow, mourn and weep, let your laughter become mourning and joy become sadness is an antithesis of a text in the Old Testament, but I don't know where that text is, and it's not in my Bible. So let's go on. Verses 11 and 12. Katrina, would you read those two verses?
Brothers and sisters, do not slander one another. Anyone who speaks against a brother or sister or judges them speaks against the law and judges it. When you judge the law, you are not keeping it, but sitting in judgment on it. There is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and destroy. But you, who are you to judge your neighbor?
So don't be critical, judgmental. You've all heard my conversion story. Several weeks before my conversion, I was at camp meeting criticizing everybody in eye distance. I had become the most able judge of humankind, I think, of anybody around me. I was totally legalistic. After my conversion, I remember going to church and loving everybody. I think what judgmentalism and criticizing and all that indicates is that we have a deficit of love in our hearts. And we've turned ourselves into criticizing and condemning everybody as a means of not loving them. And some critics and judges will tell you that they do their criticizing and judgmentalism in order to love people. That's a loving gesture for them. I didn't see it that way, but I didn't have the love of Jesus in my heart when I did that. So I just see this as the reason you're a judge of the law. When you judge other people and you criticize them and condemn them, is that you're judging love. You're showing that you put a condemnation point against love. Oh, okay, you found the Old Testament texts.
Well, there were some, but I just wondered, that was the first one that popped up when I searched.
This is a day holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn or weep. I love these texts about God's holiness that aren't about destruction. Because there's an evangelical view that God's holiness is destructive. And this one is obviously not about that. Thank you for sharing that, Katrina. Anything else about these verses before we move on? I don't know if we'll get to chapter 5 or not, but we can try. Whoever insults or criticizes a brother or sister insults and criticizes the law. That's pretty strong. How does that work?
Interesting how he's prioritizing the law here.
And I think he must have in mind that the law is the law of love. That's the only way it makes sense to me. You're judging if you're judging a person, you're not loving them. You're therefore judging the law.
Well, it's to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, so it's primarily Jewish Christian communities that he's writing to, so he appeals to the law because that's a very central part of their identity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on. Mark, would you read verses 13 to 17?
13 through 17. Mm-hmm. Now listen to me, you that say, today or tomorrow we will travel to a certain city where we will stay a year and go into business and make a lot of money. You don't even know what your life tomorrow will be. You're like a puff of smoke, which appears for a moment and then disappears. What you should say is this, if the Lord is willing, we will live and do this or that. But now you are proud and you boast. All such boasting is wrong. So then the person who does not do the good he knows is and the good. So the person who does not do the good he knows he should do is guilty of sin.
If I have a family and we decide to go camping, I should say, if the Lord wills, we will go camping next weekend. I'm trying to wrap my mind around this. I know that the Islamic community will say, if Allah wills it.
Inshallah.
Oh, one of my memories of my papa, my mother's father, is that he would use this expression in his language. Now, I knew him, you know, when he was older, I was a little girl, but he would say, Lord willing, tomorrow we'll go and do this. Now, he wouldn't use it in every sentence, but it would come out, you know, Lord willing, let's go and plan this. And so I got used to hearing that. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was nice that he was recognizing God in his, not just in his plans internally, but in his speech as well. And like I said, it wasn't like he didn't flood every sentence with it, but he used to say it, you know, fairly often. Like we'd talk about something and then, oh, Lord willing, we'll do this then.
Yeah, you know, maybe I should have done that more as a child when I thought about what I was going to do when I got older. My first goal. Well, if I went back farther, there were other calls along the way, but when I finally reached a mature level of, quote, mature level of 12, I wanted to be an editor. Fortunately, God did not will that. But I should have, because I then decided when I was 16 that I wanted to teach religion on the college level. I wanted to teach biblical studies on the college level. And I thought that was my decision. I didn't consult God about it, as I recall. I got disillusioned with Bible classes because of the way they were taught, badly. And I gave up on the idea of being being a Bible teacher on the college level. I decided instead to major in journalism and become an editor. Went back to that view. At second year in college, God took me by the nape of the neck and said, you're going to be a theologian. You know? And I was shocked to find that my decision when I was 16 was God's idea. So it would have been helpful for me to think, is this God's will or not, and pray about it. To me, this is an invitation to pray about what we do, rather than just to say, if God wills it, we will do it.
Doesn't the text itself supply the context? Because he goes on to talk about the boasting and pride.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's talking about.
Yeah, this idea, I'm going to make a lot of money, and that sounds like somebody who's bragging, doesn't it?
One says carry on business and make money. I mean, you need to make money to live. There's nothing wrong with making money.
I'm just thinking of people I've heard who are given to bragging, and they brag in that manner. I think you have to hear the tone of voice that James may be implying. I may be wrong, but that's how it strikes me a little bit.
Boasting about tomorrow, that's the subheading of the little part for mine.
We don't really know about tomorrow.
Well, we bring everything to God in prayer.
Mm-hmm. That's what I feel this is a call to prayer. And then if we're constantly praying about what we do tomorrow or the next day, and asking God to take charge of what we do, then we're not likely to tell people what we're going to do unless it concerns them.
Or we're asking for prayer about it.
We're asking for prayer about it, yeah.
Because I make decisions and I think this is the direction I want to go in, but Lord, I'm willing for you to change my plans. But as far as I can see, this is what needs to happen next. And then something will come in and to start impressing you. God will just start laying another foundation. It's like God just open up that path before me, or he broadens our path. He truly leads us. I believe that. Mm-hmm. He leads us in all areas of our life. And yes, I make plans, but I'm always willing to set them aside. If God shows me something else, I prefer to follow his way, always his way.
So verse 17, it is a sin when someone knows the right thing to do and doesn't do it. That's very Old Testament. The unintentional sin and the intentional sin, Leviticus.
I was thinking of I was very saddened about this story, a big story in England about the woman, Sarah Everglade, who was taken by a police officer, driven out to a remote area, was raped and strangled, and taken off a very busy road, 33, beautiful, beautiful young woman with her life ahead of her. Had just moved away from her parents' home and, you know, wanted to have her own apartment and some independence. But, you know, he was a police officer who was convicted just this week. And he was shown from the maximum prison in England. And while his sentence was read, he had his head, you know, down. And he did express remorse, but the betrayal felt double fold because he was a police officer. And the last time they saw her alive, she was standing next to his car and his sirens were flashing. And he said there was some story about how, oh, he underpaid a prostitute and so he owed these men a girl. And so he just, you know, randomly picked a girl off the street to take to these three men so that they could rape her and strangle her. Like, that was his story. But being a police officer, he clearly knew that all that behavior was wrong. And so the chief commissioner in England, you know, made this statement yesterday. It was a woman, and she said, look, we all feel deeply betrayed by the evil actions of this person, you know, someone who was a police officer and did this. Like, people's moral sensibility, you know, we know that this is wrong, and you've betrayed us as a profession as well by what he did. And we want you to know that we're praying for the family and friends and that we are, you know, beside ourselves, or, you know, also about this person's actions. And so, you know, what James is saying, it makes sense that, you know, people know right from wrong, basic right from wrong, and yet people make the choice to do evil over good, and that this represents a betrayal not just to themselves but really to the rest of humanity. And so we do, you know, we all reflect God's image, and when we seek what is good and right, that we are reflecting God in that. Even if we're not Christians, we are still representing the, you know, God whose image we are.
Which we would be less likely to do things we know we shouldn't if we took everything we do to God, which I think is the heart of what's above this verse.
There's something that I have recently been made aware of in my own life and been trying to do something about it. And that is, I always kind of looked at this checking in with God as something that I did from time to time. And so it's easy to read this verse in that context. Well, you know, go check in with God every once in a while. The concept I've learned, though, is that that's not often enough for me. In fact, there is no often enough. I need to be living moment by moment in constant contact with God, to be living in God's presence. And then this this becomes not nearly so much of an issue. God's there all the time. I'm in constant contact with God. At least that's my goal. That's my desire. And then I can hear say, no, Mark, that's not really what I want you to be doing right now.
Yeah, I've been struck by that thought myself. I read something in Ellen White's writings to that effect, to be constantly in touch with God. I think the more we sense his presence, the more we live in tune with him. So I'm thinking about that a lot.
So there's a famous book by Brother Lawrence called Practicing the Presence of God. And it's a very small book, but it's about, you know, his life. He worked as a cook in the monastery. He had a leg injury from war, but gradually he was getting ulcers and he was in too much pain. But people used to come, you know, wealthy people, other people used to come and seek his counsel because he was so close to God. But he had this way. He always understood that he was in God's presence. And then they shifted him. In the monastery, he was like mending shoes or doing something like that. But he had very, you know, a simple but good understanding of how to be in God's presence. It's something that I teach my students as well, about how to practice God's presence or how to be aware of God's presence in your daily life, even in your most humble duties, that you realize that God is present and that you can turn your mind to God, not that your mind always has to be focused on God, because we need to focus on tasks, we need to get things done, but to be able to go to that place and to bring honor to God by doing so and talking to him is a beautiful thing.
The trick is to bring God into the task. Those don't have to be different things.
I like to think that God is already there. We just don't recognize him.
Yeah. Where are you going to go that God is?
I'm preaching.
Yes, it's very much a matter of our awareness.
I'm preaching a sermon on Genesis 28, Jacob at Bethel.
Oh.
And the ziggurat staircase.
What?
What? Pardon?
Why are you preaching that?
At Sunnyside Church in Portland, Oregon. I feel that, I've titled my sermon, God, the Great Initiator of Relationships. Because it's my belief that God is the one always drawing people to himself and initiating the relationship.
Absolutely.
And the story of Jacob is just a classic example of that. But his presence, that's another theme I want to bring out, is the presence of God. Because it says in the text that God was on top of the ladder. But there's other translations that use a minor possibility that's found in some of the lexicons, that he was beside the ladder or beside Jacob.
Oh, Ellen White has a whole interesting theology of that. She talks about the mystic ladder as Christ.
Mm-hmm. Which is, I'm going to bring out, yeah. I'm going to bring out before the end of the sermon.
You said ziggurat. Is that the original word as opposed to ladder?
Well, in Hebrew, it's just a word that denotes either a staircase or a ladder. But ancient ziggurats, which Jacob was likely somewhat familiar with from Grandpa Abraham, having come from Mesopotamia, ziggurats were built by the gods. They were built by the gods, but in reality, they were built by the people to try to attract the gods to come down and be in the temple. And I'm going to use that as the basis for saying that the great distinguishing factor between Yahweh in Israel and, say, Nana or Sin, the moon god in Ur, is that God in Israel, you don't have to work to get him to come down to you. You don't have to build something to try to get him to come down to him. You don't have to draw on him to get him to come down to you. God is working on you to draw you up to him.
I've always appreciated your pointing out that that's really the significant thing in the Sabbath is the Sabbath. The Sabbath points us back to a different God who we don't have to.
We don't have to
slave for it.
Yeah, we don't have to slave for it. We don't have to work on his mood. We don't have to.
Yeah.
I think it's time to quit. We've gotten through chapter 4. Chapter 5 is going to take us probably 2 sessions, and then we'll be in 1 Peter. Let's pray. Gracious Father, thank you for pointing out so many things that we need to pay attention to, that sometimes we let slip behind us. Thank you for being with us today as we peruse this chapter, chapter 4 of James. May we take it to heart. May we live it in our lives. And most of all, may we do it because we sense your presence, because we are filled with your love, and that we are truly in you. We thank you for this in Jesus' name. Amen.